back together again. You and I kicking off a brand new week, Monday, February 13th, 2023. Right here on Connecticut Today, we offer the very latest briefing from National Security Council spokesman John Kirby on more objects shot down by U.S. forces over the weekend. Kent Heckenlively, co-author of This Was CNN, How Sex, Lies, and Spies Undid the World's Worst News Network, joined us to chat about his investigation. And a Heritage Foundation analyst, Maya Clark, talked about the U.S. military's ongoing support of Ukraine in its war with Russia. All right, Monday, new day, new week. How are you? 203-333-9422-333-WICC. And why? Oh, heck. Why don't we start with this?
It is balloon!
All right, there you go. We'll give you an update now. Sorry, I promised Melissa this morning I would do this. No, but seriously, I figured let's start with this, because within the past hour, John Kirby, the spokesman, the mouthpiece for the National Security Agency, John Kirby, in fact, he just got done, so he spoke with reporters for about an hour here as to what's going on with all this stuff up above us. First, we wouldn't say anything about the Chinese balloon. And then we started shooting down everything. Four shoot downs, actually three, after the Chinese balloon on the 4th of this month. Then the bigger balloon over Alaska on the 10th of this month, 3 days ago. And then on the 11th, on Saturday, we shot something down over Canada. And then yesterday, right around Super Bowl time or before that, we shot down something over Lake Huron, the Great Lakes region. Well, everybody on Capitol Hill now and all the media folks and, you know, from left to right and right to left, and the Democrats and Republicans are saying, okay, time out here, guys. What is this about? So let's start with this. I've got to give you a good chunk of this before traffic and weather together. And this is now what the White House is saying and what many, I guess, members of Congress want to hear and what folks like you and I want to hear. Just you don't have to give the great unwashed anything that has national security implications. But at first, you didn't shoot down anything, even one that was kind of hopscotching across the U.S., and now you're shooting down everything. Like, you know, if your kids' balloon, Daddy, where's my balloon going? Well, don't worry, son. An F-22 Raptor will be up there to shoot it down momentarily. But in all seriousness, this, about an hour ago, was National Security Agency spokesman John Kirby at the White House.
I'd like to begin today by updating you on our efforts to recover the debris of several objects that the United States Air Force shot down over the last few days, as well as that of the spy balloon belonging to the People's Republic of China. And I'd like to put into some context for you how we have worked and are still working to better understand the issue of high-altitude, low-speed craft. Now, let me start with the Chinese program. When President Biden came into office, he directed the U.S. intelligence community to do a broad assessment of Chinese intelligence capabilities and to ensure that we were working to detect and to protect against them. I think for reasons that you will all understand, we cannot publicly go into many details about how we discover and counteract foreign intelligence collection efforts, because much of what we have done and are doing is, of course, sensitive. But we were able to determine that China has a high-altitude balloon program for intelligence collection that's connected to the People's Liberation Army. It was operating during the previous administration, but they did not detect it. We detected it. We tracked it. And we have been carefully studying it to learn as much as we can. We know that these PRC surveillance balloons have crossed over dozens of countries on multiple continents around the world, including some of our closest allies and partners. We assessed that at this time, these balloons have provided limited additive capabilities to the PRC's other intelligence platforms used over the United States. But in the future, if the PRC continues to advance this technology, it certainly could become more valuable to them. The president also instructed the intelligence community to take a broad look at the phenomenon of unidentified aerial objects. Indeed, President Biden conducted the first ever daily intelligence briefing session devoted to this phenomenon back in June of 2021. He was briefed that this is not just an issue for the United States, but one for the rest of the world. And as I said, our friends and our partners are dealing with this as well. We worked on a bipartisan basis to stand up an office at the Pentagon to study this, in partnership with the intelligence community, academic institutions, and the private sector. These unidentified aerial phenomena have been reported for many years without explanation or deep examination by the government. President Biden has changed all that. We are finally trying to understand them better. Now, in light of the Chinese balloon program and this recent incursion into our airspace, the United States and Canada, through NORAD, have been more closely scrutinizing that airspace, including enhancing our radar capabilities, which, as the commander of NORTHCOM and NORAD, General Van Herk, said just last night, may at least partially explain the increase in the objects that have been detected. Slow-moving objects at high altitude with a small radar cross-section are difficult to detect on radar. Even objects the size of the Chinese spy balloon, which had a payload the size of roughly 3 school buses, were not picked up by previous administrations or other countries. We also know that a range of entities, including countries, companies, research, and academic organizations, operate objects at these altitudes for purposes that are not nefarious at all, including scientific research. That said, because we have not yet been able to definitively assess what these most recent objects are, we acted out of an abundance of caution to protect the security, our interest, and flight safety. In Saturday's case, we acted in consultation with the Canadian government, the president speaking personally with Prime Minister Trudeau. The spy balloon was, of course, different because we knew precisely where that was. As we have said, we do not assess that these most recent objects posed any direct threat to people on the ground, and we are laser focused on confirming their nature and purpose, including through intensive efforts to collect debris in the remote locations where they have fallen. In each instance, we have followed the same basic course. We assessed whether they posed any kinetic threat to people on the ground. They did not. We assessed whether they were sending any communication signals. We detected none. We looked to see whether they were maneuvering or had any propulsion capabilities. We saw no signs of that. And we made sure to determine whether or not they were manned. They were not. We did, however, assess that their altitudes were considerably lower than the Chinese high-altitude balloon and did pose a threat to civilian commercial air traffic. And while we have no specific reason to suspect that they were conducting surveillance of any kind, we couldn't rule that out. That is why the president, at the recommendation of the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the NORTHCOM NORAD commander, gave the order to shoot them down. These missions were completed successfully and safely. Efforts are actively underway right now at all sites to find what is left of those objects so that we can better understand and communicate with the American people what they are. I think it's important to remind the objects in Alaska and Canada are in pretty remote terrain, ice and wilderness, all of that making it difficult to find them in winter weather. The object over Lake Huron now lies in what is probably very deep water. So outside of recovery operations, what are we doing? Well, first, we are continuing to monitor. There are no active tracks today, but the professionals at NORAD will continue to do their important work. Secondly, we are consulting with allies and partners on the challenge of identified aerial phenomenon and how we can all work together to deal with that challenge. The President has directed the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and the Director of National Intelligence to engage with their relevant counterparts to share information and to try to gain their perspectives as well. Again, this is an issue that affects everybody around the world. Third, we will continue to brief members of Congress and relevant state leadership on what we are doing and what we learn. The President has made this a very top priority. We have, over the course of just the last few days, and certainly over the course of last week, reached out to inform and brief members of Congress and relevant state governors of the operations that we were conducting and of the recovery operations that are underway. We've also kept Congress briefed generally on this issue of Chinese surveillance balloons, including classified briefings last August. And last week, administration officials provided classified briefings for all senators and all members of the House of Representatives on the PRC surveillance balloon. We fully expect and anticipate and support the ability to continue these briefings in the days ahead. And fourth, the president, through his national security advisor, has today directed an interagency team to study the broader policy implications for detection, analysis, and disposition of unidentified aerial objects that pose either safety or security risks. Every element of the government will redouble their efforts to understand and mitigate these events. And I'm happy to take some questions.
John, if the objects don't pose a military threat and they don't pose a threat to anybody on the ground, why shoot them down? Particularly because the military has is routinely monitoring radar, you know, radar blips.
I kind of covered that in the opening statement. Two real reasons here. First, there was a very real potential risk to civilian air traffic. The one shot down on yesterday, was about 20,000 feet. And the two shot down Friday and Saturday were at about 40,000 feet. And as you know, transcontinental air traffic is roughly around 30,000 feet. It depends, of course, on weather. And so because we assessed that they weren't manned and weren't being controlled, therefore left to atmospheric conditions, the real risk to safety of flight was a problem. The second purpose, and I talked about this earlier too, was even though we had no indications that any of these three objects were surveilling, we couldn't rule that out. And so there, you know, you want to err on the side of safety here in terms of protecting our national security interests, and the fact that these objects could have and likely did at some point in their path transit over, you know, potential military sites of ours or sensitive sites. So again, out of an abundance of caution for those two reasons, the president, with the recommendation of his military leaders, directed them to be taken down.
All right, there you go. And there's a perfect example of that reporter asking, well, why'd you shoot them down? And I love John Kirby there saying, well, you know, as I said, wink, wink. In other words, if you had been listening, Toots, the Toots is my emphasis, not John Kirby's, the spokesman there for the National Security Council. He said, hello, are you listening? Some of these things are floating around the atmospheric levels or the altitudes of commercial air traffic. So there you go. What'd you think of all that? And coming back, this almost generates more questions than it answers. It answers some, but I wanted to play that chunk for you right off the hopper here as we get up and going on a Monday and early part of the week. A lot of things were in that chunk of audio there rather interesting. Millions of Americans on a daily basis probably take in some level of cable television news, more than likely some bit of a CNN and or Fox and or MSNBC. Now, way before Fox and MSNBC were on the scene, CNN came on the scene, late 70s, early 80s. Back then, there was almost no opinion programming except for, I think, Crossfire and something after that in the early days. And CNN's original logo was, the first name in news, or this is CNN. They used something like that. And they just kind of gave you the news. Now, we know where cable news is now, but there's a fascinating new book about the state of CNN out now. This was CNN, How Sex, get this, folks, How Sex, Lies, and Spies Undid the World's Worst News Network. How about that? A lot of people, including myself, were introduced to cable news via CNN. Joining us right now is one of the co-authors of the book, New York Times best-selling author Kent Heckenlively is with us. Hey, Kent, it's Paul here at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good, Paul. And yourself?
Very well, thank you. Now, the origin of this book, you teamed out. You were sought out, Kent, right, by a gentleman named Carrie Porch, is it, who was, I guess, an affirmed liberal, a Bernie Sanders supporter, right, who went to work for CNN, and this person says they were appalled by what they saw inside. Pick up the story. What gives here?
Yeah, so this is my third story with a Project Veritas whistleblower, so I jokingly say I feel like I've become the unofficial biographer of Project Veritas whistleblowers. And Carrie's has an interesting story. He joined CNN as a Bernie Sanders supporter, and he was hired as the satellite uplink technician, which means he's the guy who gets the news van all ready to go, races out to the location, races out to the location, gets all the technology set up, and then goes and has the coffee while the anchors or the reporters broadcast the story from the location.
Sure.
And so his first major job was to drive the van down to Charlottesville, Virginia, for the riots that took place there. And so he was on scene as CNN developed their fine people hoax, in which the claim was made that Trump had said that the neo-Nazis and other people protesting the Confederate statues were fine people, when he did nothing of the sort. And even though Kerry was a Bernie Sanders supporter, he was still an honest guy, you know? And I think that's something that we need to keep in mind, is that a lot of these people who may be ideologically opposed to us, you know, let's remember to be kind and respectful towards them and say, and just point out the information. And, you know, Kerry's eyes were really opened by that, because he said, you know, Trump said what any U.S. president should say in response to a terrible tragedy, and very quickly. And at the same time, half an hour before that crazed lunatic drove into the crowd, CNN had on David Duke, the former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. And so if there's anybody who is sort of, you know, creating division and controversy, it was CNN. And that led Kerry on a political odyssey, which ended up with him hooking up with James O'Keefe and saying he wanted to film undercover so that people could understand the political bias, which was present at CNN.
At a time when Chris Licht has been brought in to kind of maybe get CNN back to what it was decades ago, just kind of a down-the-middle news organization, our guest is Kent Heckenlively. His book, This Was CNN, How Sex, Lies, and Spies Undid the World's Worst News Network. Now, Kent, you gave us that story early on a few seconds ago about Carrie Porch, a very liberal, a progressive Bernie Sanders supporter who didn't like what he saw at CNN, and we're still debating, a lot of people are, you know, what did Mr. Trump mean by very fine people? But there's got to be more than that. What else did you two talk about, write about, that you want people to know that you allege goes on inside CNN, which, again, like 20, 30 years ago, it was hailed as this kind of down-the-middle news network and now is basically fighting for its survival?
Yeah, so one of the things that Kerry Porch uncovered is this remarkable bias inside CNN, and it was also noted by a number of their longtime employees. And so, you know, the book starts with the bias and us understanding the bias, documenting the bias, seeing what's going on. And then we take a look, a deeper look. Mm-hmm. So I hired one of the world's great research groups, and I said, you know, look at CNN. I have a number of questions. And, you know, they, of course, they came back to me and they said, look, you know, we don't know what we're going to find, but we'll tell you what's there. And, you know, you may be disappointed or you may be excited.
Okay.
And they came to back to me with two really interesting problems, you know, in areas of investigation.
Yeah.
First of all, CNN has a digital intelligence group, which is ostensibly supposed to protect their computer network. Okay. And the guys I hired were experts in cybersecurity. And they said, Kent, we're really concerned about this because CNN's a company of, you know, 4,000 people are listed working for them. It seems to be more like 6,000-7,000 when you put on independent contractors and that sort of thing. But they have a digital intelligence group of more than 220 employees. And so for a company that size, they only really need something like 20, 25 people. So why do they have a digital intelligence group that is, you know, 10 times larger than is necessary? Well, when they started looking at the people who were in charge of this digital intelligence group, they found people like this guy, Edwin Covert, who had a background in naval cryptology. He'd been employed by the U.S. Army Electronic Warfare Test Directorate. He'd been a senior technician at Booz Allen Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And they found a couple guys like that at the top, and they said, Kent, these are people with expertise in digital warfighting experience. So why does CNN have this huge digital intelligence group if staffed by people who know how to cause problems with the other side, not just protect their network? And so, you know, we question why CNN has such a large digital intelligence group, which seems to have significant offensive capabilities. And that led us to another question, which really is an unanswered question from the 1970s, and mm-hmm. one that liberals asked very much during the 70s, which was how much were our news media influenced by the intelligence agencies? So there was a really definitive article put together by Carl Bernstein in Rolling Stone in 1977, mm-hmm. which listed how there were 400 intelligence agents, intelligence assets in our media being used by the CIA. Now, because William Colby and former CIA Director George W. Bush never let those names get out, the American public never got to have a discussion about how much our news had been compromised during the Cold War. Well, what my guys found was a really strange pattern of journalists leaving journalism for a year or two, going to work for the government mm-hmm. in an intelligence capacity, and then going back to journalism. Probably the most prominent of those is Jim Secuto, who's their national security correspondent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From December 2011 to May of 2013, he was chief of staff at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, China, and special advisor to our ambassador. Now, you can't tell me that in that position, our country's deepest, darkest secrets didn't pass through his hands.
So,
you can't tell me that he didn't sign security oaths. So how is it that this journalist who's supposed to speak truth to power goes to work for power, signs security oaths and secrecy oaths with power, and then goes back on the news?
So, Kent Heckenlively is the guest, by the way. Name of the book, This Was CNN, How Sex, Lies, and Spies Undid the World's Worst News Network. So, Kent, that's a pretty heavy accusation here. Did CNN in any way respond to this? Did their corporate end, their lawyer end, have they gotten back to you on this? Were you able to ask them outright?
Well, what we did was my publisher was very concerned by these findings.
Sure.
Now, I'm not saying that I'm telling you the intelligence agencies are doing this. I'm telling you this is where they work. This is their own public information. And so what we did was we vetted the information with two individuals, one who is a 33-year FBI agent, and then the second was Danny Sheehan, who is one of the country's greatest constitutional law experts. He's one of the four attorneys who handled the Pentagon Papers case.
Oh, yeah.
He's the one who developed the information which led to the Iran-Contra scandal being revealed. And it was really interesting. So, you know, I got one guy on the right, I got another guy on the left. You know, the FBI agent said, "That's really interesting. You know, maybe sometimes people are fluffing their resumes a little bit because we got it from publicly available information." He goes, "But these are really dramatic questions you're asking, and I think you're onto something." And then, you know, I talked to the lefty, Danny Sheehan, mm-hmm. and, you know, his comment to me is, "Oh, you've just scratched the surface on this thing. You probably found the dumbest 21 intelligence agents in all of our intelligence agencies, because they bragged about their intelligence training on their own websites or, you know, LinkedIn or whatever it is." So I really got verification that you know, this is a serious question because, you know, I remember a time when a journalist wouldn't go out to dinner with a politician because they
never
worried about being influenced.
I mean, there are some old-line journalists, Kent, that there are some old-line journalists, I mean, old-line journalists, names that people would recognize who some of them I've read didn't even vote. They wouldn't even vote to make sure they were down the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like we've lost that. And, you know, what I have done with this book, and this is often what I do with my books, is I'm not hiding. I actually sent signed copies of my book to both John Malone, who's the new owner of CNN, and Chris Licht. And I said, look, I'm not an enemy of CNN. I'm a critic. If you want to talk about anything, here's my phone number. So I'm interested in having a conversation. Point out to me anything I got wrong.
Sure.
But, you know, maybe my conclusions are wrong. I mean, at the end of the book, I say, okay, there's three possibilities here. One, I got all my facts right, but all my conclusions are wrong. You know, number two, maybe the intelligence agencies had it out for Donald Trump, as was said by Chuck Schumer with Rachel Maddow.
Yeah, on national television, he said it. Yeah.
You know, maybe we're just watching, you know, a schoolyard fight between the intelligence agencies and Trump. That's concerning. Or, and this is the conclusion that I have the least amount of evidence for, but it seems the best fit for the evidence, which is, I'm wondering if these people in power, call it the bureaucracy, call it the deep state, you know, call it the swamp. I'm wondering if these people honestly don't believe that we deserve the truth, and that they want to manipulate us into their preordained narratives, and we're just falling for it. And they just, you know, unlike Lincoln, who said, tell the people the truth and then trust them to make the decision. I wonder if certain elements of our government have said, hey, the people are too stupid to be told the truth. Tell them lies instead.
Interesting thought. Folks, get the book. The name of the book, This Was CNN, How Sex, Lies, and Spies Undid the World's Worst News Network. Listen to it, audiobook, get it in print shape, Audible, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and decide for yourself. Kent Heckenlively has been the guest. Hey, Kent, thanks. Appreciate it. Take care, and we'll talk down the road.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Kent. Joining us right now is Heritage Foundation expert Maya Clark. She's a senior research associate of the Defense Industrial Base at the Center for National Defense. A lot of folks wondering, with all the military aid that we are giving out all over the world, particularly to Ukraine and its ongoing battle against the invasion of Russia, are our forces as armed as they should be? Some people might think that's a crazy question. Other people might think it's a good question. Maya Clark joins us. Hi, Maya. It's Paul at WICC in Connecticut. How are you?
Very good, thanks. And how are you?
I'm good, Maya. Nothing is getting shot out of the sky above you, right? There are no balloons or anything getting
visible debris as I look out the window here on the dome of the Capitol building.
Okay.
Nothing falling from the sky.
Because one of my previous callers was wondering, you know, hey, is there anything over Washington? So you right now, Maya, can go on the record and say you're seeing no aliens that we know of over the Capitol.
None that I know of, but no. I will keep you posted through the interview.
Excellent. Thank you. Maya, is this a real concern? I know this is your area of study, and I'm kind of starting to see these little bubble articles kind of bubble up over the past couple of weeks. Hey, we love Ukraine. We love the Ukrainians. We have to defeat Putin. But I know a lot of folks in the military, Maya, are starting to say, hey, we need to maintain a certain amount of readiness of our forces. Talk about that.
That's absolutely right. So when it comes, especially where we're seeing this problem, is with munitions, the things like Stinger missiles, javelins, and also just artillery shells that we're sending to Ukraine. The United States has maintained a stockpile of these things, but it's not as if we have giant warehouses, you know, and we just have an infinite supply of these things that we can be sending off. And the fighting in Ukraine has been pretty intense. And so what we're seeing is that pretty quickly spending that aid has depleted the U.S.'s own stocks of that. And that's a problem not just because the stocks are getting depleted, but because it's going to take our defense industry quite a bit of time to begin replenishing those munitions.
With the all the well-deserved aid we are giving to Ukraine forces, is America's stockpile of munitions. Yes, the stuff that we shoot at other people, the missiles, the cannon rounds, the gun rounds, is all that being maintained? To talk about that, Maya Clark, again, more time with her. She's a senior research and defense analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Maya, are our defense contractors, the people that actually make the big things that find the bad guys and bad girls and explode, are we able to keep up with this or not?
So we are still able to manufacture these things, but it quickly became obvious back in last spring that these big contractors, and I'm talking, you know, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, big companies, it will still take them, you know, 18 months to 2 years to make some of these systems. You know, part of that is that munitions these days can get pretty complicated. They're not just a giant bullet. It's got electronics inside. They have seeker heads that allow them to be precision guided. And there's a lot of components that go into those. And so if you're going to ramp up production to, say, replace the stockpile that you've sent to Ukraine or sent somewhere else, you really need lead time to talk to your suppliers, and they have to talk to their suppliers and all start making more. So it can be done. Contracts are getting signed to begin replacing those, but there is no quick replenishment of any of these items.
And that's the thing, Maya Clark, that kind of worries me. I wonder if part of Vladimir Putin's thinking here is that, well, you know, I may win or I may lose in Ukraine, but the longer I maintain my end of the bargain to keeping it attacking the Ukrainians here and the Ukraine forces, you know, supported by NATO and the West and the U.S., you know, the more they have to compensate and help Ukraine. So even if I'm not winning, I'm still weakening the West. I wonder if that's a factor in his strategy or not.
I would believe it. And I think that the United States has not really taken into account, as it's, you know, the Pentagon does lots of planning. They do lots of thinking through, okay, well, these are the bad guys in the world, and if we went to war with them, what might that look like? The problem is, if they say, oh, well, it could look like a two-year-long war, preparing for a two-year-long war is incredibly expensive, and we just haven't been investing in our defense to a degree that we could afford that. And so as a result, Putin could say, yeah, maybe we can just wear down the West in this way, and he'd be right. But I would say on the flip side, this conflict in Ukraine, while it's not immediately endangering the United States and, you know, our homeland, it is showing us, gee, we better be able to make some of these munitions. And in some ways, it's, you know, to call it a blessing seems like the wrong term, but it's a good lesson as we enter into great power competition with China. If we're learning this lesson now against Russia instead of in a few years against China, maybe we'll be better prepared then to meet these challenges.
And ever since back in World War II, Maya, and the guest is defense analyst Maya Clark from the Heritage Foundation, you know, we learned back then that there was a time for 4 or 5 years we had to fight a two-front war, a front in Europe and a front in the Pacific. And it's amazing how we did that, and we won with the help of allies on both fronts. But I remember a few years ago, Maya, the Pentagon saying that they were kind of standing down a little from the notion of a two-front war here. And again, if you watch what's going on now, I would think that's got people in Iran and North Korea and China kind of, you know, with their eyes wide open here.
That's right. We, during the Obama administration years, changed from a two-front war construct to kind of a 1.5 major regional contingency MRC construct. And, you know, doing that allows you to spend less on defense, mm-hmm. which, you know, sometimes is the politically expedient thing to do, but it does leave you more vulnerable. And it does put us in a situation where, as we're sending massive aid to Ukraine, that has costs for other sides of U.S. national security.
Check out her articles, folks, at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. Maya Clark has been the guest. Maya, thank you. Appreciate the time. Take care, and we'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Heritage.org, Maya, M-A-I-Y-A, Clark, Senior Research Associate for the Defense Industrial Base at the Center for National Defense and the Heritage Foundation. So, yeah, we'll see. And I'm starting to read things bubbling up online now where there's a little bit of concern here. Listen, not to the point where I know there are some, particularly in the Republican Party, who want to go almost isolationist again. But you have to think that Vladimir Putin and some other folks are saying, well, you know, the more money that the West spends fighting me, the weaker they're going to become. You know, that's an amazing thing. And I've been lately, I don't know why, one of them popped up in my social media feeds, but I've been binge listening to old World War II era radio news broadcasts. Of course, you know, 10 years prior to the advent of any real television. So it was newspapers, but you know, radio news had their real thumb on the pulse of what was going on and informing people, millions across the U.S. every night, of World War II. They couldn't see it. They couldn't read about it online. It was in the newspapers and on radio. And in particular, that was the era of Eric Severide, Richard C. Hodlett, Douglas Edwards, Ed Murrow, H.V. Kaltenborn. I mean, people that not only reported the news, but interpreted it. And the thing that I find amazing listening to those broadcasts is that World War II was being fought. And I know people know this, but you kind of have to remind yourself. It's one of those things where you have to kind of kick yourself to remind it. World War II was being fought on two different fronts. I mean, the European theater against, you know, Germany with Russia on our side back then, and the Pacific theater against Japan. And the South Pacific Islands and all that. And it was amazing that this country, or maybe it's not amazing, maybe it's who we are. But we went from really a low state of readiness. I mean, you couldn't even call it that when we were attacked on December 7th of 1941, Pearl Harbor Day, to when, you know, to the eventual surrender of Germany after, you know, the Russian army and the U.S. ended up meeting in Germany and splitting the country, and that ended quickly after that. Then the use of two atomic bombs against Japan. But all that happening in about four and a half years. But we were fighting two wars. And to hear these old newscasters, or old, not old back then, but, you know, old reports of saying, first, let's give you an update on the European front, and now on the Pacific front. It's fascinating. It was just fascinating to listen to.